The power of a tribune for life. He was linking himself to the tradition of popular politicians going back at least to the Gracchi, who stood up for the rights and welfare of the Roman in the street. The final theme is his building. One part of this was a massive programme of restorations of everything from roads and aqueducts to the Temple of Jupiter on the Capitoline, the founding monument of the Republic. With tremendous bravura, Augustus claims to have restored 82 temples of the gods in a single year, a number not far short of all the temples in the city, that is clearly intended to underline his zealous piety, although it also suggests that the practical work done on each was not substantial. But like many tyrants, monarchs and dictators before and since, he also set about constructing what was in effect a new Rome, and literally building himself into power. The Res Gestae itemises a wholesale redevelopment of the city centre, which exploited for the first time the marble quarries of northern Italy and the most lustrous, colourful and expensive stones that the empire had to offer. It turned the ramshackle old town into something that looked like an imperial capital. There was a huge new forum to rival, if not overshadow, the old one, a new senate house, a theatre, still standing as the theatre of Marcellus. Porticos, public halls, or basilicas, and walkways, as well as more than a dozen new temples, including one in honour of his father, Julius Caesar. When Augustus said, as Suetonius quotes him, "I found the city built of brick, and left it built of marble," this is what he meant. The Res Gestae provides a gazetteer of his transformation of Rome's urban landscape. It also amounts to a clear blueprint for one-man rule. Augustus's power, as he formulates it, is signalled by military conquest, by his role of protector and benefactor of the people in Rome, and by construction and reconstruction on a vast scale. And it was underpinned by massive reserves of cash, combined with the display of respect for the ancient traditions of Rome. It was against this blueprint that every emperor for the next 200 years was to be judged. Even the most unmilitary types could use conquest to assert their right to rule, as the elderly Claudius did in 43 CE, when he made as much as he possibly could out of his victory, won entirely by his subordinates, over the island of Britain. And there was an ongoing competition among succeeding rulers about who could parade himself as the most generous to the Roman population, or who could write his own story most noticeably into the fabric of the city. The Emperor Trajan's soaring column, documenting his conquests across the River Danube in the early 2nd century CE, and ingeniously securing maximum impact for minimum floor area, was one obvious winner. Hadrian's Pantheon was another. Finished in the 120 CE, the concrete span of its dome remained the widest in the world until 1958, when it was beaten by the Centre of New Industries and Technologies building in Paris. And 12 of the original columns in its portico were each 12 metres high, carved from a single block of grey granite, and specially transported 2,500 miles from the Egyptian desert. Ultimately, this all went back to Augustus. Power politics. The Res Gestae was always intended as a record of success, a retrospective parade of achievement that would also set a pattern for the future. It steers clear of any sign of difficulty, conflict or contest, except in briefly dismissing the long-dead adversaries of the Civil War. And with its insistent series of the first-person verbs, I paid, I built, I gave, and matching pronouns, there are almost 100 me's and mine's. It is more egocentric than any Roman public document before, composed in the style of an autocrat who appears to take his personal power for granted. That is, however, only one side of the Augustan story, seen from its successful end after more than 40 years in power. It looked very different when he returned to Italy in 29 BCE, still as Octavian, with the example of Julius Caesar looming large. Caesar was his main access to power and legitimacy, as well as to that title, Son of a God. But he was also a warning of the fate that might lie in store. To be the son of an assassinated dictator was a mixed blessing. The big question in those early days was simple. How was he going to devise a form of rule that would win hearts and minds, defuse the opposition not wholly extinguished by the end of the war, and allow him to stay alive? Part of the answer came down to the language of power. For obvious Roman reasons, he did not call himself king. He made an elaborate show of rejecting the title dictator, too, distancing himself from Caesar's example. The story that a crowd of protesters once barricaded the senators into the Senate House and threatened to burn it down over their heads if they did not make Augustus a dictator only added extra lustre to this refusal. Instead, he chose to frame all his powers in terms of regular republican office holding. To begin with, that meant being repeatedly elected consul, 11 times in all, between 43 and 23 BCE, and on two isolated occasions later. Then, from the mid-20s BCE, he arranged to be granted a series of formal powers that were modelled on those of traditional Roman political offices, but not the offices themselves. He took the power of a tribune, but did not hold the tribunate, and the rights of a consul without holding the consulship. This was a long way from the realities of traditional republican practice, especially when he piled up multiple titles and offices together. The power of a tribune, on top of the rights of a consul at the same time, was unheard of. So too was his holding of not just one, but all the major Roman priesthoods together. Whatever the later allegations of hypocrisy, he can hardly have been using these comfortable old-fashioned titles to pretend that this was a return to the politics of the past. Romans were not, by and large, so unobservant that they would have failed to spot the autocracy lurking behind the fig leaf of the rights of a consul. The point was that Augustus was cleverly adapting the traditional idioms to serve a new politics, justifying and making comprehensible a new axis of power by systematically reconfiguring an old language. His rule was also presented as inevitable, as part of the natural and historical order. In short, as part of how things were. In 8 BCE, the Senate decided, who knows with what nudging, that the month Sextilis, next to Julius Caesar's July, should be renamed August. And so Augustus became part of the regular passage of time, as he remains. Only the year before, the governor of the province of Asia had been thinking on similar lines when he persuaded the locals to align their calendar with the life cycle of the emperor, and to begin their civic year on Augustus's birthday. The 23rd of September, the governor urged, in words still preserved in an inscription, might justly be considered equal to the beginning of all things, for Augustus has given a different appearance to the whole world, a world which would have met its ruin if he had not been born. In Rome, the language used might have been less overblown, but even there, myth and religion could usefully underpin Augustus's position. His claim to descend directly from Aeneas helped to portray the emperor as a fulfilment of Roman destiny, as the ordained re-founder of Rome. That is certainly one element in Virgil's epic story of Aeneas, with its clear echoes between the emperor and the legendary founding hero. But it is also seen vividly in the sculptural programme of Augustus's new forum. This featured prominent statues of both Aeneas and Romulus and one of Augustus standing in a triumphal chariot in the centre of the piazza. The surrounding porticos and arcades were lined with dozens of other statues depicting the famous men of the Republic, each with a short text summing up his claim to fame, from Camillus and several Scipios to Marius and Sulla. The clear message was that the whole course of Roman history led up to Augustus, who now took centre stage. The story of the Republic had not been obliterated. It had been turned into a harmless backdrop to Augustan power, whose roots were founded in the very origin of Rome. Or, to put it another way, Augustus took over where the previous politics of Rome had collapsed. It was widely known that he was born in 63 BCE, the year of Catiline's conspiracy. Suetonius even claims that his father was held up by the birth and so was late for one of Cicero's big performances in the Senate on the subject. No senatorial meeting was held on the 23rd of September, so far as is known. But whether the story was an invention or not, the point was to present the same day as both the end of Republican politics, demonstrated in the corruption of Catiline, and the beginning of the life of the emperor. There was, however, some much more ruthless realpolitik involved than this. Art, religion, myth, symbol and language, from the poetry of Virgil to the sculptural extravaganza of the new forum, played an important part in grounding the new regime. But Augustus also took some down-to-earth steps to secure his position, by ensuring that the army was loyal to him and to no one else, by cutting off potential opponents from their support networks among the soldiers and the ordinary people, and by transforming the Senate from an aristocracy of competing dynasts and possible rivals into an aristocracy of service and honour. A classic poacher-turned-gamekeeper, Augustus set out to make sure that no one could easily follow the example of his own youth. That is, raise a private army and take over the state. He took a monopoly on military force, but his regime was nothing like a modern military dictatorship. In our terms, Rome and Italy at this period were remarkably soldier-free. Almost all the 300,000 Roman troops were stationed a safe distance away near the boundaries of the Roman world, and in areas of active campaigning, with only a very few troops, including the famous security forces known as the Praetorian Guard, based in Rome, which was otherwise a demilitarized zone. But Augustus became something no Roman had been before. The commander-in-chief of all the armed forces, who appointed their major officers, decided where and against whom the soldiers should fight, and claimed all victories as, by definition, his own, whoever had commanded on the ground. He also secured his position by severing the links of dependence and personal loyalty between armies and their individual commanders, largely thanks to a simple, practical process of pension reform. This must count among the most significant innovations of his whole rule. He established uniform terms and conditions of army employment, fixing a standard term of service of 16 years, soon raised to 20, for legionaries, and guaranteeing them on retirement a cash settlement at public expense, amounting to about 12 times their annual pay, or an equivalent in land. That ended once and for all the soldiers' reliance on their generals to provide for their retirement, which over the last century of the Republic had repeatedly led to the soldiers' private loyalty to their commander, trumping their loyalty to Rome. In other words, after hundreds of years of a semi-public, semi-private militia, Augustus fully nationalized the Roman legions and removed them from politics. Although the Praetorian Guard continued to be a problematic political force, simply because of its proximity to the centre of power in Rome, only during two brief periods of civil war over the next two centuries, in the years 68 to 69 CE, and again in 193 CE, were legions stationed outside the city instrumental in putting their candidates on the Roman throne. This reform was one of the most expensive things Augustus ever did, and it was close to unaffordable. Unless he made a gross error in his arithmetic, the cost alone is an indication of the high priority he gave it, On a rough reckoning, using the known military salary figures, the annual bill for regular pay, combined with retirement packages for the whole army, would now have come to about 450 million sesterces. That was, on an even rougher reckoning, the equivalent of more than half the total annual tax revenue of the empire. There are clear signs that, even with the huge reserves of state and emperor combined, it was hard to find the money. It is certainly the implication of the complaints of mutinous soldiers on the German frontier just after Augustus's death, who objected to being kept in service for much longer than the regulation 20 years, or to being given a piece of worthless bog as a land settlement in lieu of a decent farm. Then, as now, the easiest tactic for a government trying to reduce the pension bill was to raise the pension age. At home, there was a similar logic behind the gradual decline and eventual end of popular elections. This was not mainly an assault on what was left of Roman democracy, even if that was one inevitable consequence. More important, it was a clever way of inserting a wedge between the emperor's potential rivals and any large-scale popular or factional support in the city. Free elections had provided the glue of mutual dependence between prominent politicians and the people as a whole. As soon as ambitious individuals came to rely on the nod of the emperor rather than on the popular vote for public office and other sorts of preferment, they no longer had to attract the support of the people en masse. They were no longer compelled to build up a popular following, and they had no institutional framework within which to do so. The intention was, as the res gestae more or less declares, that Augustus should monopolize the support of the people, edging the senators safely out of the picture. Yet, for all his autocratic power, Augustus still needed the Senate. No sole ruler ever really rules alone. The Roman Empire had a light administrative footprint compared with the bureaucracy of all modern states, and some ancient ones too. Even so, someone had to command the legions, govern the provinces, run the corn and water supplies, and generally act as the deputy for an emperor who could not do everything. As is often the case in regime change, the new guard is more or less forced to rely on a carefully reformed version of the old guard, or, as we have seen in recent history, anarchy can result. In broad terms, Augustus bought senatorial acquiescence and senatorial service at the price of granting them honours, respect, and in some cases, new powers. Many of the old uncertainties were resolved, usually in the Senate's favour. Senatorial decrees had previously been advisory only, and in the last resort could be ignored or flouted, which was exactly what Caesar and Pompey did in 50 BCE when the Senate instructed them both to disarm. These decrees were now given the force of law, and gradually, along with the pronouncements of the emperor, became the main form of Roman legislation. The split that Gaius Gracchus had opened up in the 120s BCE between senators and knights was made complete. The two groups were formally separated, and a new wealth qualification of 1,000,000 sesterces as against 400,000 for the knights was now applied to a senatorial class. Senatorial status was also made hereditary over 3 generations. That meant a senator's son and grandson could keep all the perks of being a senator without ever taking public office. Those perks increased, too, as did the prohibitions that were intended to mark senatorial superiority. Guaranteed front-row seats at all public shows on the one hand, an absolute ban on performing as an actor on the other. In return, the Senate became something much closer to an arm of administration in the service of the emperor. Augustus's introduction of a senatorial retirement age is just one hint of that. Senators also lost some of their most important and traditional marks of glory and status. For centuries, the acme of Roman ambition, the dream of every commander, even of the awkwardly unmilitary Cicero, had been to celebrate a triumph, parading through the streets with his spoils, prisoners, and jubilant troops, dressed up as the god Jupiter. When, on the 27th of March, 19 BCE, Lucius Cornelius Bulbus, a one-time henchman of Julius Caesar, celebrated some victories he had scored on behalf of the new Augustan regime against some powerful Berber people on the edge of the Sahara, it was the last triumphal procession that an ordinary senatorial general was ever to have. Henceforth, the ceremony was restricted entirely to emperors and their close family. It was not in the interests of the autocracy to share the fame and prominence that a triumph brought. And this was another glaring sign that the old republic was finished. It was also another case where a radical change of practice was made to seem somehow inevitable. As part of his celebration of the past, as the past, Augustus commissioned the register of all the triumphing generals from Romulus to Bulbus, displayed in the Roman Forum. Much of it still survives, dug up in small fragments of a marble jigsaw puzzle that was first put together, it is said, by Michelangelo in the 16th century to decorate the new Palazzo dei Conservatori that he redesigned for the Capitoline Hill. It was laid out on four panels, and thanks to careful calculation on the part of the inscribers, the triumph of Bulbus is recorded at the very bottom of the final panel, with no blank space underneath, leaving no room for more names. More than design symmetry was at stake here. The message was that the institution had not been interrupted in midstream. It had come to its natural end. There was no room for more. Problems and successions. Things did not all go Augustus's way. Even through the generally celebratory ancient gloss on his rule, it is possible to glimpse what a much more troubled account might look like. In 9 CE, 5 years before his death, there was a terrible military disaster in Germany at the hands of local rebels and freedom fighters, which destroyed most of three legions. It did not stop the pacification of Germany from being a proud boast in the Res Gestae, but the severity of this defeat is supposed to have prompted Augustus to call a halt to projects for world conquest. At home, there was more overt opposition to his rule than appears at first sight. There was offensive literature which ended up being burnt, and conspiracies which he probably survived as much by luck as by anything else. Suetonius lists a number of dissidents and plotters, but as always, with failed coups, it is hard to tell what was driving them between politics and personal grudges. It is never in the interests of the intended victim to give them a fair press. In one case, it seems likely that the changed political role of the elite and Augustus's control of elections was a major factor behind the discontent. The story of Marcus Ignatius Rufus, as it has come down to us, is predictably muddled in detail, but the bare bones are clear enough. Ignatius, first of all, challenged Augustus by making independent benefactions to the people. In particular, when he held the office of aedile in 22 BCE, he used his own cash to set up a rudimentary city fire brigade. Augustus disapproved, but decided to trump Ignatius by making 600 of his own slaves available for firefighting. A few years later, while Augustus was abroad, Ignatius attempted to stand for the consulship without the emperor's approval and at an illegally early age. This cannot have been an organized plot against the emperor. He was not in Rome to be disposed of anyway, which might have been why Ignatius thought he could get away with his stand. But when his candidacy was refused, there were popular riots. He was executed on the decision of the Senate, presumably with the absent emperor's agreement. How many of his fellow senators sympathized with Ignatius Rufus is a matter of guesswork. We know nothing of his background and can only infer what his aims and motives were. Some modern historians have wanted to make him a kind of people's champion on the model of Clodius and other tribunes in the late Republic. but it looks much more likely that he was protesting against the erosion of senatorial independence and asserting the rights of the senators to their traditional links with the Roman people. Beyond frontline politics, there were certainly subversive views of the symbolic world that Augustus was busy sponsoring and his new image of Rome. The poet Ovid, a victim of the ruthless side of the Augustan regime, gives clear hints how the mutterings on the streets might have gone. Writing from his unhappy exile on the shores of the Black Sea, in a series of poems titled Miseries, Tristia, often more barbed than sad, he took a witty potshot at the decoration of the temple dominating Augustus's new forum, which featured statues of the gods Mars and Venus. As the father of Romulus and the mother of Aeneas, these were the two founding deities of Rome. They were also the two most famous divine adulterers of classical mythology. As far back as Homer, the story had been told of how Venus's cuckolded husband, Vulcan, the god of manufacture, had caught the pair embarrassingly in flagrante, cleverly trapping them in a metal net he specially constructed for the purpose. Hardly the appropriate symbol for the emperor's new moral Rome, where adultery was a crime, the exiled poet insinuated. Some of the elaborate displays of civilitas may have backfired too. If it is really true that each time Augustus entered or left the Senate, he acknowledged every senator in turn by name, the whole palaver, allowing 10 seconds per man and a fairly full house, would have taken about an hour and a half on entry and exit. For some, it must have seemed a display of power rather than citizenly equality. Even Virgil's Aeneid, the epic poem sponsored by the emperor himself, prompts troubling questions. The figure of Aeneas, Augustus's mythical ancestor, and clearly intended to be some reflection of him, is a decidedly unstraightforward hero. Modern readers are probably much more disturbed than their ancient counterparts were by the way Aeneas abandons the unfortunate Dido and causes her terrible suicide on the pyre. The message is that mere passion should not deflect the pursuit of patriotic duty, and the dangerous image of Cleopatra behind the Queen of Carthage underlines the point. But the final scene of the poem, in which Aeneas, now established in Italy, allows his rage to triumph as he brutally kills an enemy who has surrendered, has always been an unsettling conclusion. Such ambivalences have, of course, made the Aeneid a more powerful work of literature than thousands of lines of jingoistic praise would have been. But they continue to raise questions about Virgil's relationship with his patron and the Augustan regime. What went through Augustus's head when he first read or listened to those last lines? That was not for Virgil to tell. He died in 19 BCE before, it was said, he had completed the final revision of his poem. Augustus's bigger problem, however, was how to find a successor. It is clear that he intended to pass his power on. His enormous tomb in Rome, already completed in 28 BCE, was a powerful sign that he, unlike Antony, would be buried in Italian soil and that there would be a dynasty to follow him. He also built up the idea of an imperial family, including his wife Livia. One-man rule often brings women into greater prominence, not because they necessarily have any formal power, but because, when one person takes key decisions of state in private, anyone with close access to that person is perceived as influential too. The woman who can whisper in her husband's ear wields more power de facto, or rather is often alleged to, than the colleague who can only send official requests and memos. On one occasion, Augustus acknowledged in a letter to the Greek city of Samos that Livia had been putting in a good word for it behind the scenes. But he seems more actively to have promoted her role beyond this, as a linchpin of his dynastic ambitions. Livia had an official image in Roman sculpture, just as Augustus did. and she was granted a series of special legal privileges, including front-row seats at the theatre, financial independence, and, from the Civil War years, the right of sacrosanctitas, inviolability, modelled on the privilege of a tribune. Sacrosanctitas had originated in the Republic and had been intended to protect the people's representatives from attack. What, in practice, it protected Livia from is not so clear. But the important novelty is that it was explicitly based on the rights of a male public official. This was edging her into the official limelight more than any woman had been edged before. One poem addressed to her on the death of her son, Drusus, in 9 BCE, even calls her Romana Princeps. It was the female equivalent of a term regularly applied to Augustus, Romanus Princeps, or First Citizen of Rome, and meant something close to First Lady. An extravagant piece of hyperbole composed by a flatterer, maybe, and certainly not a sign of growing emancipation of women in general, but it points to the public importance of the emperor's wife within a would-be imperial dynasty. The trouble was that the couple had no children. Augustus had a single daughter, Julia, from an earlier marriage, and Livia already had Drusus, and was pregnant with another son, Tiberius, when they married in 37 BCE. Whatever their later respectability, the start to their relationship had a scandalous tinge, branded by Antony as a disgraceful bit of philandering, in retaliation, presumably, for all the vicious rumours spread about his immoralities, he used to claim that the pair would meet at her husband's parties, go off to a convenient bedroom halfway through dinner, and return looking tousled. But scandalous or respectable, the marriage produced no offspring. With Augustus, according to Suetonius, Livia had had just one premature stillbirth. So the emperor went to great lengths to secure heirs who could be presented, in the circumstances, as legitimate successors. Julia, as his natural daughter, was the favourite instrument in his plans. She was married off first to her cousin Marcellus, who died when she was only 16, then to her father's friend and colleague, Marcus Agrippa, more than 20 years her senior, then, in what must have looked the perfect arrangement, to Livia's son, Tiberius. If an existing partner stood in the way of any of these matches, Augustus insisted on divorce. Only rarely does any hint survive of the personal cost of it all. Tiberius was reportedly devastated to be forced to part from his wife, Vipsania Agrippina, the daughter of Agrippa by an earlier marriage, in order to marry Julia, who was now Agrippa's widow. A characteristic bit of dynastic confusion. On one occasion, after their divorce, Tiberius is said to have caught sight of Vipsania by chance, and it brought tears to his eyes. His minders made sure that he never saw her again. As for Julia, it may be that this series of arranged marriages had something to do with her notoriously rebellious sex life. One lurid story has it that she hosted wild parties on the rostra in the forum. By a satisfying or horrible symmetry, it was the very place from which her father had advocated his curbs on adultery. True or not, her affairs were one of the factors, alleged treason was another, that led to her being packed off in 2 BCE to exile on an island about half a mile square, and never returning to Rome. The end result of all this dynastic planning is that the family tree of what is now called the Julio-Claudian dynasty, Julius being Augustus's family name, Claudius that of Livia's first husband, became so bafflingly complicated that it is impossible to diagram clearly on paper, let alone recall in any detail. But even so, the desired heirs either did not appear, or, if they did, died too soon. The marriage of Tiberius and Julia produced only one child, who did not survive childhood. Augustus adopted two sons of her marriage to Agrippa as a way of marking them out as heirs, while further confusing the family tree. They were carefully portrayed around the Roman world, looking the spitting image of their adoptive father. But one died of an illness in 2 CE, aged just 19, and the other in 4 CE after being wounded on campaign in the East and before his marriage to another relative had produced a child. In the end, despite all his efforts, Augustus was back where he could have started all along with Livia's son, Tiberius, who became the next emperor in 14 CE. Pliny the Elder could not resist pointing out one other irony of this. Tiberius Claudius Nero, the new emperor's father, had been on Antony's side in the civil war, and his family had been among those besieged at Perusia. Augustus died, Pliny quipped, with the son of his enemy as his heir. Augustus is dead. Long live Augustus. Augustus died on the 19th of August, 14 CE, shortly before his 76th birthday, at one of his houses in southern Italy. According to Suetonius, he had been holidaying on the island of Capri, playing learned games with his guests, insisting, for example, that all the Roman guests should dress as Greeks and speak Greek, while all the Greek guests should act as Romans. The end was all very low-key. By the time he returned to the mainland, his stomach was giving him trouble, and eventually it forced him to his bed, where, somewhat surprisingly, given the fate of so many of his contemporaries, he died. There were rumours later that Livia had had a hand in his end, with some poisoned figs, to ease Tiberius's accession to power, just as some had said she had hastened the end of other family members for fear that they would spoil Tiberius's chances of the throne. But it was another case of unexplained deaths in the Roman world, as the majority were outside battle, childbirth and accident, attracting that sort of gossip, whether there was any foundation for it or not, and poisoning was always supposed to be the woman's weapon of choice. It required no physical strength, only cunning, and was a frightful inversion of her traditional role of nurturer. Others believed, more plausibly, that Livia played a major part in smoothing the transition from Augustus to Tiberius. As soon as her husband's death looked imminent, she sent for her son, who was about 5 days' journey away, across the Adriatic. Meanwhile, she kept issuing optimistic bulletins about Augustus's health, until Tiberius arrived and the death could be announced. When the old man really died was always a matter of dispute. But whether it was before or after his heir's arrival, the accession proved fairly seamless. The body was carried for more than 100 miles to Rome, from where he died at Nola, on the shoulders of the leading men of the towns along the route. There was no coronation ceremony. Whatever use Augustus had made of his triumph in 29 BCE, there was no specific Roman ritual to mark imperial accession. But Tiberius was already effectively in control as the new emperor when he arranged a meeting of the Senate to make public Augustus's will, bequests, and other instructions for the future, and to discuss the funeral arrangements. There are a few hints that the organisers were anxious about possible trouble. Why else did they have the ceremony and the funeral route guarded by troops? But all passed off peacefully, and in a way that would have been more or less familiar to Polybius more than 150 years earlier, even if on a more lavish scale. A wax model of Augustus, not the body itself, was propped up on the rostra while Tiberius delivered the funeral address. The procession featured images not only of Augustus's ancestors, but also of great Romans of the past, including Pompey and Romulus, as if Augustus had been the descendant of them all. After the cremation, Livia, now called Augusta, because Augustus had formally adopted her in his will, rewarded with the sum of 1,000,000 sesterces the man who swore that he had seen Augustus soaring to heaven. Augustus was now a god. The emperor, in his human form, remained enigmatic to the last. Among his final words to his assembled friends before a lingering kiss with Livia was a characteristically shifty quotation from a Greek comedy. "If I have played my part well, then give me applause." What kind of act had he been playing all those years, they were supposed to wonder? And where was the real Augustus? And who wrote his lines? Those questions remain. How Augustus managed to recast so much of the political landscape of Rome, how he managed to get his own way for more than 40 years, and with what support, is still puzzling. Who, for example, made the decision about his or Livia's official image? What kind of discussions, and with whom, lay behind the new scheme for army service and pensions? How far was he simply lucky to have survived so long? Nonetheless, the broad framework he set out for being an emperor lasted for more than 200 years, or, to put it another way, for the rest of the period covered by this book. Every later emperor we shall meet was, or at least, impersonated Augustus. They used the name Augustus among their imperial titles, and they inherited his personal signet ring, which is supposed to have passed down the line from one to the next. This was no longer his original favourite, the Sphinx. Over the decades he had changed the design, first to a portrait of Alexander the Great, and finally to a portrait of himself. Augustus's head, in other words, and his distinctive features became the signature of each of his successors. Whatever their idiosyncrasies, virtues, vices, or backgrounds, whatever the different names we know them by, they were all better or worse reincarnations of Augustus, operating within the model of autocracy he established and dealing with the problems that he left unresolved. It is to some of the problems facing this series of new Augusti that we now turn, starting with another death. Chapter 10. 14 Emperors, the Men on the Throne. On the 24th of January 41 CE, almost 30 years after the first Augustus had died in his bed, and 85 years after the death of Julius Caesar, there was another violent assassination in Rome. This time the victim was the Emperor Gaius, or, to give him his full name, Gaius Julius Caesar Augustus Germanicus, who 4 years earlier had succeeded his great-uncle, the elderly Tiberius, to the throne. He was the second in the series of 14 emperors, not counting 3 short-lived claimants, in one brief period of civil war through 68 and 69 CE, who ruled Rome in the almost 180 years between the death of Augustus and that of the Emperor Commodus, who was assassinated in 192 CE. These include some of the most resonant names in Roman history. Claudius, who replaced Gaius and was given a starring role as a scholarly and shrewd observer of palace politics in the novels of Robert Graves, I, Claudius, and Claudius the God. Nero, with his reputation for family murder, lyre-playing, Christian persecution, and pyromania. Marcus Aurelius, the philosopher emperor, whose philosophical Thoughts is even now a bestseller. And Commodus, whose exploits in the arena were recreated, not wholly inaccurately, in the movie Gladiator. They also include those who, despite all the ingenuity of modern biographers, survive as little more than names. The elderly Nerva, for example, who held power for just 18 months at the end of the 1st century CE. The murder of Gaius is one of the best documented events in this whole period of Roman history, and it certainly gives us the most detailed account to survive of any emperor's fall. It is told over 30 modern pages, as an elaborate digression, within an encyclopedic history of the Jews, written some 50 years after the event by Titus Flavius Josephus, a leading Jewish rebel against the Romans in the 60s CE, under the name of Joseph ben Matthias, who changed sides politically, if not religiously, and ended up almost a writer in residence at the Roman court. For Josephus, Gaius's murder was divine punishment visited upon an emperor who had scorned the Jews and even erected a statue of himself in the temple. But to judge from the circumstantial details in retelling the story, he had on his desk a memoir of what happened in January 41 CE, written by someone close to the action. Josephus's account of the assassination is richly revealing about the new world of politics that followed the first Augustus, from the palace intrigues through the empty slogans of the old senatorial elite and the problems of succession to the perils of being an emperor on the throne. What is more, the various assessments, both ancient and modern, of Gaius's faults and failings, of what lay behind his murder, and of what followed it, point to important questions about how the reputation of Roman emperors was created, about how their success or failure was and is judged, even more fundamentally, about how far the character and qualities, marriages and murders of the individual rulers help us understand the broader history of Rome under imperial rule. So, how was Gaius killed, and why? What went wrong with Gaius? The Emperor Tiberius, who took over from his adoptive father Augustus, apparently seamlessly, in 14 CE, grew increasingly reclusive over the last decade of his rule, spending most of his time on the island of Capri, only remotely in touch with the capital. When Gaius was acclaimed emperor on Tiberius's death in 37 CE, he must have seemed like a welcome change. Just 24 years old, he had as good a claim to the throne as any Julio-Claudian could hope for. His mother, Agrippina, was the daughter of Julia, and so the granddaughter of Augustus in his direct bloodline. His father, Germanicus, once tipped as a future emperor before his early and predictably suspicious death, was both a grandson of Livia and a great-nephew of Augustus. It was thanks to his parents that Gaius ended up with the embarrassing nickname Caligula, Bootykins, by which he is now better known. They had taken him as a young child on military campaigns and dressed him up in a miniature soldier's uniform, including some trademark miniature army boots, Caligae in Latin. His assassination, after just 4 years on the throne by three soldiers from the Praetorian Guard, was as bloody and messy as Caesar's. In the ancient world, murder was rarely possible from a safe distance. Killing usually meant getting up close and often spilling a lot of blood. As both Caesar and Gaius found, anyone in power was most at risk from those who were allowed to come closest to them. From wives and children, bodyguards, colleagues, friends, and slaves. Yet the contrast between the two assassinations is striking too, and a sign of changed times between the Republic and the rule of the emperors. It was fellow senators who stabbed Caesar at a public meeting, in full view as they were presenting a petition. Gaius was hacked to pieces at home, all alone in a deserted corridor by some of the crack troops who were supposed to ensure the regime's home security. And when his wife came with her baby daughter to find the body, they too were eliminated. The emperor, Josephus explains, had been watching some performances on the Palatine Hill at the annual festival held there in memory of the first Augustus, timed to coincide with the wedding anniversary of the first imperial couple. At the end of the morning's show, he decided to skip lunch. Another version claims he was feeling slightly nauseous after overindulging the night before, and to go on his own from the theatre to his private baths. As he walked down a passage between two of the properties that were part of the growing palace complex, already far more extensive than Augustus's relatively modest accommodation, the three Praetorian NCOs in our terms attacked him. A personal grudge reputedly drove the leader, Cassius Chaerea. He had often acted as the emperor's agent, torturer, and enforcer. But Gaius, in return, is supposed to have repeatedly and publicly mocked his effeminacy. Girly was one of the favourite taunts. This was Chaerea's revenge. There may also have been some higher principles driving the plot, and more widespread support for it among soldiers and senators, or so the many stories told of Gaius's villainies suggest. His incest with his sisters and his mad plans to make his horse a consul have become notorious. His vanity building projects have been placed somewhere on the spectrum between an affront to the laws of nature and ludicrous display. Imagine him, as more than one ancient writer pictures the scene, prancing on horseback along a roadway constructed on top of a bridge of boats across the Bay of Naples, wearing the breastplate of Alexander the Great. His valiant soldiers were disgracefully humiliated by being made to hunt for seashells on a French beach, and his gleeful menace directed at the long-suffering Roman aristocracy became legendary. On one famous occasion, he was caught bursting into laughter at a palace dinner party when he was reclining next to two consuls. "What's the joke?" one asked politely. "Just the thought that I would only have to nod, and your throats would be cut on the spot," came the reply. Someone else would have wielded the knife if Chaerea had not. Whatever the exact motives for the assassination, however, this was a new politics, a hit squad operating behind closed doors, and a dynastic murder that demanded that the victim's immediate family should share his fate. No one had gone after Julius Caesar's wife. It also revealed that, despite Augustus's largely successful attempts to remove the Roman legions from politics, the few soldiers stationed in the city could wield an enormous amount of power if they chose. In 41 CE, it was not just that a group of disaffected Praetorians killed one emperor. The Praetorian Guard immediately installed his successor. The emperor's most intimate personal bodyguard, a small private militia of Germans, chosen because their barbarity was thought to be a guarantee against corruption, also played a bloody part in what happened next. As soon as news of the murder leaked out, the Germans proved their brutal, thuggish loyalty. They ran through the Palatine, killing anyone they suspected of involvement in the plot. One senator was slaughtered because his toga was splattered with animal blood from a religious sacrifice earlier in the day, which gave the impression that he might have been involved in the emperor's killing. And they terrorized the people who were still mingling in the theatre after the emperor had left. These remnants of the audience were barricaded in until a kindly doctor intervened. He had come there to treat those who had been wounded in the aftermath of the assassination, and he engineered the evacuation of the innocent bystanders by sending them off on the pretext of picking up medical supplies. Meanwhile, the Senate met in the Temple of Jupiter on the Capitoline Hill, the great symbolic monument of the Republic, and exchanged fine words about the end of political slavery and the return of liberty. It was 100 years, they calculated, since freedom had been lost, presumably thinking that the deal arranged in 60 BCE by Pompey, Caesar and Crassus as the Gang of Three was the turning point. And so it was a particularly auspicious moment to reclaim it. The consul, Gnaeus Sentius Saturninus, delivered the most stirring speech. He was too young, he admitted, to remember the Republic, but he had seen with his own eyes the evils with which tyrannies fill the state. A new dawn had come with the murder of Gaius. No despot is set over you now, who can get away with ruining the city. What recently nurtured the tyranny was nothing other than our inaction. Weakened by the pleasure of peace, we learned to live like slaves. Our first duty now is to give the highest possible honours to those who have killed the tyrant. This sounded impressive, but proved hollow. All the time Saturninus spoke, he was wearing his usual signet ring, which loyally featured the head of Gaius. One observer, spotting the inconsistency between the words and the jewellery, went up and tore it off his finger. The whole performance was in any case too late. The Praetorian Guard, who had a very low view of the capabilities of the Senate, and no desire to return to the Republic, had already picked a new emperor. The story was that, terrified by the violence and commotion, Gaius's uncle, the 50-year-old Claudius, had hidden himself down another dark alley. But he was quickly discovered by the Praetorians and, though fearing he too was about to be killed, was hailed as emperor instead. His blood relationship with Livia and Augustus made him as plausible a candidate as anyone, and he was conveniently on the spot. Edgy negotiations, careful publicity, and awkward decisions followed. Claudius gave each of the Praetorians a fast handout. The first emperor to use bribery to secure the loyalty of the soldiers, carped the biographer Suetonius, as if Augustus had not done much the same thing. The senators gave up any idea of republican liberty, and were soon demanding no more than that Claudius should formally accept the throne from them, while most of them quickly scuttled off to the safety of their country estates. Instead of receiving the highest possible honours, Chaerea and one of his fellow assassins were executed, the new emperor's advisers sternly arguing that, while the deed had been a glorious one, disloyalty should nevertheless be punished to discourage any repetition. Claudius continued to claim that he was a reluctant ruler, thrust into power against his will. Maybe that was true, but a parade of reluctance has often provided a useful cover for ruthless ambition. It was not long before sculptors across the Roman world were going with the times and were busily re-carving redundant portraits of Gaius to give them passable versions of the features of his old uncle, the new emperor. These events are a vivid snapshot of the politics of Roman autocracy almost 30 years after the death of Augustus. The Senate's ineffective posturing over the restoration of the Republic serves only to prove that the old system of government was gone for good, little more than a nostalgic fantasy conjured up by those who had never experienced it. As Josephus hints, anyone who could loudly advocate a return to republican rule, while sporting the emperor's portrait on his ring, did not understand what republican rule was about. The confusion and violence that followed the assassination not only shows how easy it was for a peaceful morning of theatrical performance to turn into a bloodbath, but also points to all kinds of different political views between Senate, soldiers, and ordinary people. The majority of the rich and privileged were celebrating the death of a tyrant. The poor were instead lamenting the murder of their hero. Josephus singles out for scorn the folly of the women, children, and slaves who were reluctant to accept the truth and joyfully believed the false rumours that Gaius had been patched up and was walking around the forum. It is clear enough that those who were pleased to see him out of the way did not agree on what should happen next. Many more did not want to see their emperor assassinated at all. Those differences of opinion challenge orthodoxies and raise some bigger historical questions. Was Gaius really as monstrous as he's been consistently painted? Had the ordinary people, as Josephus suggested, been taken in by an emperor reputed to make extravagantly generous gestures to the crowds, on one occasion, it was said, standing on top of a building in the forum and literally throwing money down at the bystanders? Maybe they had. But there are some strong reasons to be suspicious about many of the standard tales of Gaius's wickedness that we have inherited. Some of these tales are simply implausible. Leaving aside his histrionics in the Bay of Naples, could he really have built a huge bridge in Rome from the Palatine Hill to the Capitoline Hill, of which no sure trace remains? Almost all our stories were written years after the emperor's death, and the most extravagant look weaker the more they are examined. The one about the seashells may well go back to a confusion around the Latin word musculi, which can mean both shells and military huts. Were the soldiers actually dismantling a temporary camp and not on a shell hunt? And the first surviving reference to incest is found only at the end of the 1st century CE, while the clearest evidence for it seems to be his deep distress at the death of his sister Drusilla, which is hardly clinching proof of sexual relations. The idea of some modern writers that his dinner parties came close to orgies, with his sisters underneath him and his wife on top, rests simply on a mistranslation of the words of Suetonius, who is referring to the place settings above and below at a Roman dining table. It would be naive to imagine that Gaius was an innocent and benevolent ruler, horribly misunderstood or consistently misrepresented. But it is hard to resist the conclusion that, whatever kernel of truth they might have, the stories told about him are an inextricable mixture of fact, exaggeration, willful misinterpretation, and outright invention. Largely constructed after his death, and largely for the benefit of the new emperor, Claudius, whose legitimacy on the throne depended partly on the idea that his predecessor had been rightly eliminated. As it was in the interests of Augustus to vilify Antony, so it was in the interests of the Claudian regime, and of those under the new emperor, who wanted to distance themselves from the old, to pile abuse on Gaius, whatever the truth. To put it another way, Gaius may have been assassinated because he was a monster, but it is equally possible that he was made into a monster because he was assassinated. But suppose, ignoring all suspicions, that the stories are entirely accurate, that the ordinary people had been merely gullible, and that Rome had been under the rule of a mad sadist somewhere between a clinical psychopath and a Stalin. The truth is that, beyond making it absolutely clear that emperors had become a permanent fixture, the killing of Gaius had no significant impact on the long history of imperial rule at all. That was one thing the assassins of 41 CE had in common with the assassins of 44 BCE, who killed one autocrat, Julius Caesar, only to end up with another, Augustus. For all the excitement generated by the murder of Gaius, the suspense, the uncertainty of the moment, and the flirtation with republicanism, as brief as it was unrealistic, the end result was another emperor on the throne, who was not all that unlike the one he had replaced. Claudius may have had a better and far more bookish posthumous reputation than Gaius, for it was not so obviously in the interests of his adopted son and successor, Nero, to damn his memory. But scratch the surface, and he too has a grim record of cruelty and criminality. 35 senators out of a total of about 600, and 300 equestrians put to death during his rule, according to one ancient tally. And he filled the same slot in the Roman power structure. That is one message of the re-carving of the portraits of the old emperor. Economic good sense must, in part, have driven the clever alterations. Any sculptor who had nearly finished ahead of Gaius in January 41 CE would not have wanted to see his time and money wasted with a useless portrait of a deposed ruler. Far better to recast it quickly into the likeness of the new man on the throne. Some of the changes may also have been a form of symbolic elimination. Romans often tried to strike from the record those who had fallen from favour, demolishing their houses, pulling down their statues, and erasing their names from public inscriptions, often with crude chisel marks, which serve mainly to draw attention to the names they wanted forgotten. But another underlying point, much like the message of Augustus and the ravens, is that emperors were more similar to one another than they were different, and that it took only some superficial adjustments to turn one into the next. Assassinations were minor interruptions to the grander narrative of imperial rule. Good emperors and bad emperors. The standard story of the almost two centuries of autocracy between Tiberius and Commodus, those 14 emperors across three imperial dynasties, focuses on the virtues and vices of the man on the throne and on his abuse and use of autocratic power. It is hard to imagine Roman history without Nero fiddling while Rome burned, more precisely, irresponsibly playing his lyre while the city was destroyed in a vast blaze in 64 CE, bungling an attempt to murder his mother by drowning her in a collapsible boat, a peculiar combination of ingenuity, cruelty, and absurdity, or torturing Christians, as if they were to blame for the Great Fire, in the first of a sporadic series of violent Roman reactions to the new religion. But Nero is only one of a wide repertoire of different versions of imperial sadism. The Emperor Commodus, dressed as a gladiator and threatening the senators in the front row seats of the Colosseum by waving the head of a decapitated ostrich at them, is often taken to sum up the ludicrous sadism of corrupt autocracy. One eyewitness, describing the incident, admits that he was terrified, but at the same time so dangerously close to laughter that he had to pluck some laurel leaves from the wreath he was wearing and stuff them in his mouth to stifle the giggles. The antics of the reclusive Tiberius in his swimming pool on the island of Capri, where boys, little fishes, were reputedly employed to nibble at his genitals underwater, point to the exploitative sexuality of imperial power. The scenes being gleefully reenacted in Bob Guccione's 1970s film Caligula. Even more chilling is the story of how Domitian turned sadism into a solitary pastime. He is said to have shut himself up alone in his room, whiling away the hours torturing flies by killing them with his pen. "Is there anyone in there with the emperor?" someone once asked. "Not even a fly," was one courtier's sharp reply. There are occasional examples of outstanding imperial virtue too. The philosophical Thoughts of the Emperor Marcus Aurelius, cliché as much of it is, do not act as if you were going to live 10,000 years, death hangs over you, still finds many admirers, buyers and advocates today, from self-help gurus to former US President Bill Clinton. The heroic common sense of Vespasian, Domitian's father, deserves to be well known. Coming to the throne in 69 CE after the extravagant Nero, he was reputed to be a shrewd manager of the imperial finances, right down to putting a tax on human urine, a key ingredient in the ancient laundry and cloth processing industry. He almost certainly never uttered the snappy quip on the subject, "Pecunia non olet," money doesn't smell, often attributed to him. But it captures just the right spirit. He was also renowned for puncturing imperial pretensions, including his own. "That serves me right for being a silly old man and wanting a triumph at my age," he is supposed to have said at the end of his triumphal procession in 71 CE, after he had been on his feet all day in a bumpy chariot at the age of 61. These emperors are some of the most vividly drawn characters in the Roman world. But all the intriguing circumstantial details, from the swing of their togas to their bald patches, can deflect us from the more fundamental questions already glimpsed underneath the story of Gaius. How far is it useful to see Roman history in terms of imperial biographies, or to divide the story of the empire into emperor-sized or dynasty-sized chunks? How accurate are the standard images of these rulers that have come down to us? What exactly did the emperor's character explain? How much difference, and to whom, did the qualities of the man on the throne make? Ancient biographers, historians, and political analysts certainly believed that it made a great deal of difference, hence their focus on the flaws and failings, hypocrisies and sadism of the Augusti, and occasionally on their sturdy patience or tolerant good humour. Suetonius, in his series of biographies, The 12 Caesars, ranging from Julius Caesar to Domitian, including the three short-lived claimants of 68 to 69 CE, gives pride of place to the kind of revealing personal anecdotes that I have just quoted, and he lavishes attention on the diagnostic minutiae of his subjects' eating habits, style of dress, sex life, and clever sayings, from jokes to last words. It is here that we read of Tiberius's acne, Claudius's recurrent indigestion, and Domitian's habit of going swimming with prostitutes. Even the far more cerebral Publius Cornelius Tacitus relished such personal details. In his account of the first two imperial dynasties, ending with Domitian, Tacitus